This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The lead-up to directing a film is accompanied by a very slow acceleration of tense excitement, and it's a process that can sometimes last several years. I am, for the most part, what is called a slash. I direct, but I also write, and I even compose my own scores. Director, slash writer, slash composer. This immediately complicates the process because, as the writer, I am already overly attached to the ideas contained in the script. Ideas I will have thought about for a considerable amount of time before getting anywhere near the actual film set. With immense luck and good fortune, the film will get financed, and I will suddenly go into pre-production, a period of 3 months on a big studio picture, or 6 weeks on a low-budget independent film. And it's during pre-production that every vital decision has to be made. Actors and locations are chosen, the budget is revised on a daily basis, and these revisions translate into changes in the script. Decisions have to be made very, very quickly. For example, reviewing my first feature, Stormy Monday, the American film critic Roger Ebert complimented the look of the empty, wet, neon-soaked streets of Newcastle. What he didn't know was that the script had originally called for a bustling Chinese market scene. But then I had to make a choice in pre-production between that and another scene, and in the end, the Chinese market had to go. As the first day of principal photography hurtles towards me, I feel the power slipping away. My baby, that has been slowly growing in the womb of all things possible, is now expected to birth, fully formed and with very muscular legs. As this sense of unease grows, around me the circus multiplies, a crowd of initially friendly folk that will become my team for the duration of the film. During the first few weeks of filming, you will get a sense about your team, about how things are going, and, most importantly, how you yourself are doing. I say most importantly because if you don't get it right, there is no film. Lesson number one is a very hard one. The crew, for the most part, are not really interested in the end result, the finished film. Crews are not structured in that way. They are only concerned with their particular function on the film. Very few of them will ever actually see the film. And when Hollywood producers glibly trot out that famous cliché, "Hey, we're all making the same movie," this could not be further from the truth. So in order to try and make some semblance of the film you initially conceived, you have to ignore the temptation to create a nice atmosphere for the crew. This sounds harsh, but the reality is that nothing ever really gets fixed in the edit suite. By the time you are a few weeks into production, you've had a chance to see what is working and what is not working. Firstly, the actors. Maybe you got it right in the casting, or maybe you didn't. But now these people are representing your characters in your film, and you must be prepared to adjust rather than cling onto unrealistic visions. And this adjustment can have interesting results. I once made the big mistake of writing a script for a specific actor who then turned me down in favor of a big action movie. This made it very difficult for me to recast. Inevitably, tensions start to build up on the set. Earlier in my career, I had the strong desire to be a nice guy, to be the director that the crew would love. This would be countered by the knowledge that unless I pushed for something, I would not get what I knew was needed. This is the really tricky part of directing. Perhaps you're a whiz with the actors. You really know your stuff about drama. You understand the camera. All of those things which are essential to the creation of a good film. But if you lose contact with your inner voice, the truly creative force in art, then all of this means nothing. Conversely, if you only listen to your inner voice and have zero contact with the many technicians and actors around you, then the result will be a very unhappy set and it's impossible to be creative in an environment like that. On this note, the lunch break is a really crucial time for many reasons. The crew will have been thinking about it for at least an hour before the appointed time. Tummies will be rumbling, fairly loudly in the case of actors being closely mic'd. And if, for whatever reason, the sequence you are shooting goes over the time, well, let's just say one should try and avoid competing with the lunch break. On a shoot, food is in constant supply. It's usually pretty unhealthy, and there's lots of it. Tempting though they are, I try and avoid heavy carbs. I know to my cost the sluggishness that descends after lunch. Instead, I use the lunch break to play music somewhere relatively private. Often, it's impossible to escape because lunch is also the time when the director is expected to deal with the problems coming up in the days ahead. An endless series of questions arise. What kind of car? What color car? Or what outfit for the actress? Or perhaps there's a new actor arriving for a fitting and I know I should say hello. Or there's a conference call with the studio where I must explain what it is I think I am doing. David Lynch, a director, artist that I admire greatly, insists on complete privacy during his lunchtime. He goes to his trailer or a room at the location and he meditates. You can find yourself in very strange situations on a shoot. My films sometimes contain scenes which can only be described as perverse. When I'm filming such a scene, I can sense that the crew around me is uncomfortable. And I remember feeling uncomfortable myself when I wrote it, but now, engulfed by the crew, the discomfort is almost unbearable. In these moments, the temptation to pull the scene back to neutrality is so strong. But I stand by the quote by Diane Arbus about the nature of perversity and how one must be prepared to cross the line sometimes. Nevertheless, it is often so difficult to do it in front of a crowd of, well, near strangers. Another realization that came to me early on is that if you give up, well, because of fatigue or hostility, actors that argue, interfering producers, or because you simply have lost the plot, then a version of the film will still be made. All you have to do is turn up, and a bunch of people will click into action on the word action. The film might look and sound like a real film, but fundamentally it won't work. And if you give up, you still won't win any popularity polls. In fact, you will now lose the respect of the crew because they can tell when you've ceased to lead from the front. So lesson number one is that the director's job is to make the best film possible under the circumstances. Everything else has to come second, which means that maybe you don't win the popularity polls all of the time. You learn a lot of lessons the hard way when working on large studio pictures. On one such production, I remember how things began to go slowly in the camera department. Each setup was taking longer and longer. I had worked with the same crew previously on a very small independent film and had laid down rigid rules about lighting and equipment, namely, always using the minimum. Back then, we were the happiest crew ever as we whipped through scene after scene using just natural light, a tripod or handheld camera. But now, we were working on the big film with massive trucks. Filled with every technical toy in the store, it was as though everything had gone into slow motion. With a lot of time on my hands, but the clock ticking, I decided to study what was going on. I say study. But what actually happens on a film set is that one accepts the technical as a given. You see miles of cable, generators being brought in, cranes put in position, a small army of technicians with special belts full of special tools, all doing their job. Anyway, over the next couple of hours, I visited the technical setup and I made notes of how many lights were being positioned. And there were many, many lights. Finally, the set was ready. and the actors were summoned from their trailers. I went for a last visit to see which actual lights we were now going to use. I'd say that maybe 20% from the original technical setup. And the reason? Now that the DOP, the director of photography, was making a big studio film, he was insecure. He couldn't make up his mind. And because he had too many options at his disposal, he was covering all the bases. And now, he also had become aware that our relationship had just got worse. I did another big studio picture in Canada. I am not good with names, and there were so many people in this crew that it was impossible to remember them all. However, I thought at least that I would know what they looked like after 2 months of shooting. But one day I came into work, walked through the set, and I realized that I could not recognize a single face. The producer, he was still there, explained that the entire crew had walked off the film and gone on to a Michael Douglas production that was, well, actually, it was better paid. I joke about it. Stories like this make good after-dinner speech anecdotes, but they're actually not that funny. I cannot put my hand on my heart and say that I love the filmmaking experience. I love film, when it's brilliant, which is rare, and I relish the actor-director process. I used to accept that everything else was the price to be paid for the ability to create a film. But then I realized that perhaps it was not necessary to go through this sluggish process. And the realization came through a series of situations and events in 1994. After an early fluke success in Hollywood, I started to slowly fall down the ladder. I wasn't having any fun at all. I began to dream of leaving, looking back with fondness at the years of touring experimental theatre with a small company. I'd make no money, but I'd be creatively fulfilled. It was then that a gallery owner called Stuart Reagan handed me a copy of the novel Leaving Las Vegas. He'd read the book and thought it might appeal to me. It did, for reasons other than just the story itself. It was so clearly a low-budget, independent project, something that would never interest a studio. Therefore, it had a built-in insurance policy. It could only be made one way, cheaply. And in the making of that film, a personal manifesto emerged, and it's still with me now, and has developed as technology makes it possible to create films with high production value, yet with relatively small amounts of cash. Taking as my motto something Jean-Luc Godard once said, show me the budget and I'll show you the film, I've always tried to be entirely realistic with time and money. So on leaving Las Vegas, I knew the paucity of my budget and I created a crew structure and a schedule which was entirely linked to this. The result was a streamlined unit with a high energy and motivation, the polar opposite to a studio film. Now, as I prepare for my next film, the manifesto holds strong. Again, the budget is small, the equipment is digital, and the crew numbers have been reduced to an absolute minimum. Despite everything I've been through, I still know that when I turn up on the first day of the shoot, I will feel, as ever, like a beginner. I'm older, but clearly no wiser.